For our first science catch-up, let's talk about removing and reducing methane from our livestock that we raise. Methane emissions from ruminant livestock are currently estimated to be more than 100 million tons each year, and after the production of rice, represent the biggest human-initiated methane source there is. Given that fact, there's widespread encouragement for people to reduce their consumption of meat in order to reduce the amount of potent greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere. But an additional strategy to lower global methane emissions is to actually reduce the amount of methane produced by each animal. To that end, researchers at the University of Otago in New Zealand have now identified new processes that control methane production in the stomachs of sheep and similar animals like cattle and deer. They determined the specific microbes and enzymes that control the supply of hydrogen, which is the main energy source for methane-producing microbes, known as methogens. Their work is focused on the development of small molecule inhibitors and vaccines to specifically target the production of methane in the methogens. By reducing the supply of hydrogen to the methogens, it is possible to reduce animal methane emissions. The research involves studying two types of sheep, those producing large amounts of methane and those that produce less. They found that the most active hydrogen-consuming microbes differed between the sheep. Specifically, in the lower methane-emitting sheep, hydrogen-consuming bacteria dominated over the methogens. Ultimately, a strategy might emerge to introduce food supplements that encourage non-methane producers to outcompete the methogens. Controlling the supply of hydrogen to the methogens will lead to reduced methane emissions. Having lower emission cattle could definitely help reduce the impact of agriculture on our climate. While we're playing science catch-up, this morning, let's go to talk a little bit about meeting climate goals with current energy infrastructure. The Paris Climate Agreement set forth a goal to keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius, as well as a more optimistic and preferable goal of keeping the temperature rise to less than 1.5 degrees. Reaching either of these goals requires getting to net zero emissions by the middle of this century. A new paper published in Nature looks at the issue of whether existing power plants and other fossil fuel burning equipment, including vehicles we drive, can continue to operate until they age out of functionality or whether they need to be retired early. The results of the study are that future emissions from existing facilities would take up the entire carbon budget needed to limit the warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and almost 2/3 of the budget needed to keep warming below the 2-degree level over the next 30 years. So, the good news is that we will still avoid a 2-degree level without having to shut down all existing power plants early, but we would definitely have to stop building new things with smokestacks and tailpipes that dump CO2 into the atmosphere very soon. That good news is tempered by the fact that the number of fossil-burning fuel-powered plants and vehicles in the world has increased dramatically over the past decade. Spurred by rapid economic and industrial development in China and India, in fact, China is predicted to produce more than 40% of all the carbon emissions in the world over the next 30 years. The 2-degree limit is not at all the most desirable result. The 1.5-degree target would be far better for the climate. But if the world is to achieve it, there will be dramatic changes needed in the existing infrastructure, either shutting it down or retrofitting it to drastically reduced emission outputs. Now let's change gears a little bit and talk about what's going on with our coral reefs around the world. As climate change warms the ocean, subtropical environments are becoming more favorable for corals than the equatorial waters where they traditionally thrived. As a result, drifting coral larvae are settling and growing in new regions. According to new research in the journal Marine Ecology Progress series, the number of young corals on tropical reefs has declined by 85% over the last 40 years. At the same time, the numbers on subtropical reefs has doubled. Only certain types of coral can reach these new subtropical locations. That depends on how far the microscopic larvae can swim and drift on currents before they exhaust their limited fat stores. Thus, the reef ecosystems that develop have new blends of species that have previously never coexisted. It is not clear how long it'll take for the new systems to reach an equilibrium. Coral reefs are complicated systems that depend on the interplay between species to enable their healthy functioning. Apart from the corals themselves, there are the coralline algae that symbiotically coexist with them. How all of this will play out in these evolving ecosystems is still unknown. In the meantime, the research has found that these refugee corals are settling at a latitude of about 35 degrees both north and south of the equator. It is no longer so clear what constitute native species in the reefs. It remains to be seen whether new reefs in subtropical oceans can support the incredible biodiversity seen in the tropical reefs. But ultimately, these changing ecosystems could potentially bring new resources and opportunities, such as fishing and tourism, to places where they've never existed before. And since we're talking about ecosystems, let's shift from the coral reefs of the ocean to the Great Plains of the United States. The Great Plains ecosystem has been shifting northward over the past 50 years, driven by climate change, wildfire suppression, energy development, land use changes, and urbanization. The ecosystem is an area historically rich with grasslands and shrub steppes and is prime habitat for grassland birds. According to a recent study published in the journal Nature Climate Change, the northernmost ecosystem boundary of the Great Plains has moved more than 365 miles north since the year 1970, amounting to a movement of about 8 miles a year. The region's southernmost eco boundary has shifted 160 miles north, or about 4 miles a year, so the Great Plains themselves overall are actually growing. The study used bird distribution data as an indicator of shifting ecosystem boundaries. The researchers analyzed 46 years of data and 400 bird species across a 250-mile wide strip stretching from here, Texas, to North Dakota. They tracked how the birds' distributions changed as a measure of how these ecosystems were shifting. While climate change has been a major driver of these ecosystem shifts since at least the early 70s, several other factors such as wildfire trends, land use changes, and the invasion of tree species into grassland habitat have also played a role. Like most things in the ecological system, the changes are likely to have multiple causes. One cannot really separate causes like tree invasions, warming climate, and wildfires, as they are all interrelated. Using bird distribution patterns for tracking ecosystem shifts could be a useful tool for scientists and land managers in the coming decades to give them an early warning of how habitats are changing in response to rising global temperatures and therefore allow them to take action to protect vulnerable species. And now let's talk about controlling malaria without chemicals, which I'm all for. Nearly half of the world's population lives in areas vulnerable to malaria. The disease kills roughly 450,000 people each year, most of them children and pregnant women. Malaria is spread by the Anopheles mosquitoes, and over time, the mosquitoes have been developing resistance to the chemical insecticides that we used to use to control them. In addition, there's a great concern about the toxic side effects of the chemicals used on the mosquitoes as they affect the rest of the environment all around them. About 30 years ago, science identified a type of bacteria that kills the Anopheles mosquito, but the mechanism was not understood. As a result, the bacteria could not be replicated or used as an alternative to chemical insecticides. But now, an international research team headed by researchers at UC Riverside, University of California, has identified the neurotoxin produced by the bacteria and has determined how it kills the Anopheles mosquito. The work is described in a paper published in Nature Communications. It took the team 10 years to achieve a breakthrough in understanding the bacteria. Modern gene sequencing techniques were the key. While many neurotoxins target vertebrates and are highly toxic also to us, the neurotoxin that kills the Anopheles mosquito does not affect humans, vertebrates, fish, or other insects. Currently known as the PMP1, the substance is not even toxic to mice when given in a direct injection. The team has applied for a patent on this discovery and hopes to find partners to help them develop this bacteria-based insecticide. There's a high likelihood that PMP1 actually evolved to kill the Anopheles mosquito. This finding opens the door to new avenues of research into other environmentally friendly insecticides that would be targeted at other disease-spreading pests. Folks, this is a way we're going to have to do this. We can't continue poisoning our entire aquarium we live in to kill our pests. We have to figure out a way to target individual species that we need to keep control of without harming, in many cases, the beneficials that help us take care of the same pest. Now, let's round out this quarter of the show that I usually save for current science, I call it, with this final interesting fact. The July that just passed is the hottest month ever. Climate researchers announced that July was the hottest July ever recorded, and since July is generally the hottest month of the year across the world, it was indeed the hottest month ever recorded. It just barely beat out the previous record, which was a July set in 2016. But whatever July's ultimate ranking is, it is a part of a long-term trend. The past 5 years have been the hottest on record worldwide. The 10 hottest years ever recorded have all occurred during the past 20 years. The highest above-average conditions were recorded across Alaska, Greenland, and large areas of Siberia. Large parts of Africa and Australia were also warmer than ever, as was much of Central Asia. New temperature records were set in Belgium, the Netherlands, and Germany, with many temperatures over 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Great Britain saw an all-time record of 101.7 degrees, and Anchorage, Alaska stayed above 79 degrees for a record 6 days in a row. While scientists cannot directly link any particular heat wave to climate change, the trend for new heat records is likely to continue and accelerate unless we do something about curbing greenhouse gas emissions. Thanks for staying tuned to this portion of Organic Matters here on KVLF in Alpine, Texas. Appreciate you listening and hope you enjoy kind of catching up on science. And we'll be back after these commercial messages with more of the show.